So we'll move on to the first issue, which is Agenda Reference 12, Identifying Promised Goods or Services in a Contract with a Customer. Andrea is going to take us through this, I think.
Thanks, Ian. Step 2 of the new revenue standard requires an entity to identify the performance obligations in a contract with a customer. A performance obligation is a promised good or service that is distinct or a series of distinct goods or services. As previously communicated, the staff has been made aware and has undertaken a research project to clarify the guidance on determining when performance obligations are distinct in the context of the contract. But the staff would like the focus of this TRG discussion to be on the proper identification of promised goods and services. While the identification of the units of account was intended to change for some arrangements, some stakeholders think the intent of the new guidance was not to drastically change what promised items are carried through the performance obligation model. However, the staff has been made aware of a potential implementation issue related to identifying promised goods and services. That is, some stakeholders are questioning whether an entity would be required to identify and account for a significantly greater number of promised goods and services under the new revenue standard compared to the number of deliverables accounted for under current guidance. These stakeholders reference the following as contributing to the implementation issue. It is unclear when certain activities that provide some minor benefit to the customer would be considered either an administrative task or a promise to transfer a good or service to the customer. Language in the basis that states the boards decided not to specifically include guidance that would exempt an entity from accounting for performance obligations that are deemed to be inconsequential or perfunctory. Rather, an entity would consider whether those performance obligations are immaterial to its financial statements. With that background, the staff would like to know whether the TRG members think the guidance in the new revenue standard requires the identification of promised goods or services that are generally not identified as deliverables under existing guidance, and do the TRG members think the board's intent to not identify significant numbers of new promised goods or services, that is, beyond those identified as deliverables under existing guidance, is not sufficiently clear in the new revenue standard? If not, what might more clearly communicate the board's intent with respect to identifying the promised goods or services in a contract with a customer? So I'll turn it over to TRG members for discussion.
Okay, well, we'll start here. So those are the two questions at the end of Agenda Item 12. So I'd be interested in any comments in that regard. Don't be shy. No? Tony.
So my sense of this is that the standard and the guidance is actually different to what's gone before. And so I think there are circumstances in which IFRS 15 is going to require the recognition of additional performance obligations, or maybe it will just result in the recognition of different performance obligations. I think my sense is that the principle that the boards wanted to require with the new standard is clear enough, and I think it's something that could be worked with. I think there are circumstances that some of the examples that have been illustrated in the paper, I think I could look, for example, at a requirement to issue a statement and say that that's purely administrative, or it's simply one of the costs of delivering the performance obligations that are required by the contract. And so in that sense, I think I could work with the standard. Having said that, I can understand why some people might be confused or wonder what the reference to having to consider performance obligations that might be inconsequential or perfunctory means. So I can see why some might look at that, particularly if the background is they were previously told maybe not to account for that type of obligation. So I can understand why that might potentially cause some confusion. And if the boards were looking at a way of perhaps eliminating that confusion, then perhaps just deleting those words might be a way forward.
Which words are those, Tim?
There's a sentence in the basis for conclusions that says specifically that there's a requirement to consider inconsequential or perfunctory performance obligations. Now, say I might say that some of the things that are examples in the paper, I might conclude that's not a performance obligation to begin with because it's purely administrative. But I can see why some people might perhaps be a little bit confused. And so if the boards were thinking about a solution, then I don't think I would have a problem with those words coming out. I think if the boards were thinking about something beyond that, so adding to the standard, there I think it would be worth thinking about unintended consequences of adding additional words. Particularly, I think one set of the board's constituents is familiar with working with the notion of things that might be inconsequential or perfunctory. I'm not sure everybody is, and I guess I can see circumstances where something that might meet a dictionary definition of perfunctory could still be a material obligation. So I think I wouldn't have a problem, I suspect, with removing the words, but would be cautious about adding any more.
Okay. I think that the challenge is that sentence in the basis has to be read in the context of the development of the standard. And I know when you look at it in the cold light of the day, it looks a little like an instruction that you have to account for perfunctory consequentials. What it was more trying to explain was the reason why it wasn't felt that there was a need to carry forward that particular guidance.
Any other thoughts? Yes, Robert.
I just wanted to interject that materiality should be measured in the context of the use of the financial statements. Are these things sufficiently large to change the valuation? And so my interpretation of the board's basis of conclusion is you have to look at them and make sure there's nothing big there. But I wouldn't have interpreted it as, oh, by the way, you have to go through the entire shopping list and check off each one and document each one. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Andrew.
I don't know if Phil was here. Go ahead. I agree very much with Tony's comments. I think that my reading of it is that the standard's not saying you've got to identify all these things as being separate. I think it's much more don't assume that they won't be separate performance obligations. But it does seem to me that many of these things would probably be small enough that you wouldn't really worry particularly about them. And I'll come back to some of these things in a minute as well, because it depends a bit on how you look at them. I think as well as that, when you're looking at the approach, paragraph 29 in the standard itself is quite helpful, because if you read it in reverse, it gives you a bit of help in deciding what you ought to be splitting out and what you ought not. And that then perhaps is helpful in some large contracts where you've got contracts a couple of hundred pages thick, and to go through, it would really seem to me to be not what the standard's asking, to go through and find thousands of separate deliverables. If I'm building a helicopter and an aircraft or a ship, I'm building one thing. There might be some separate bits that you add on. So I think there's guidance in the standard itself which helps get you there. I'm not necessarily terribly troubled by what's in the basis. There was the other point which talks about the items that are listed in paragraph 10 of the paper. And although there's a bit of judgment involved there, I think one of the first questions I'd look at is whether is this just part of running the business? So if I'm in the business of selling electrical goods in the high street, and if someone happens to walk in off the street and says, how do I switch this on? I'm not sure that feels like a separate performance obligation to me, because after all, people who don't even buy anything could come and ask the question. It might also be looked at as being something where I, as the seller, are saying, I'll take steps to ensure that this conforms to the agreed upon specifications. and one of them is that you can make it work. And that could then all link back into it being one separate performance obligation, which would take away a bit of complexity on separating out a lot of these separate obligations. Excuse me.
Thank you. Phil, did you want to?
Yes, just to be very brief, because I very much support everything that everyone else has said. I guess there's a materiality aspect to this. I took the words about inconsequential and perfunctory not to mean you've got to go through all of these very, very carefully and assign values to them, etc. I kind of took it to mean that the judgment was instead whether they were material rather than whether they were inconsequential or perfunctory, which would seem to me to be a sensible approach. I guess it raises the question, is it sufficiently clear how materiality is to be assessed? And I'm not certain that that is as clear as it could be, because when we're looking at materiality of different things in the standard, the unit of account, if you like, is sometimes different. So in particular, when we're looking at things like financing components, we know that there might not be a significant financing component, even in circumstances where were you to aggregate all of the financing components that aren't significant, you might come up with a number that is material in the context of the financial statement. So there is a question mark for me about how is materiality to be assessed, if indeed there is a materiality get at, and I hope there is, and I guess a bit more clarity on that might be helpful. One of the main reasons why it might be helpful is actually less for the preparation of the accounts in terms of getting numbers out, and more in terms of the associated practicalities and procedures, because of course distinguishing between something that is an error, but an immaterial error, and not an error, is actually very important when you're reporting to those charged with governance. And it would be a great shame to have to report a very large number of immaterial errors that aren't really errors, they are really a sensible application of the standard. So I guess if there was to be more clarity for me on how materiality works here, I think that might be helpful, but it might be quite a difficult thing to draft, it might need a bit of care.
Brian, you've changed your mind.
I was going to make a fairly similar point. I agree with everything that's been said from a financial reporting perspective, but there is an undercurrent here around the costs of compliance and how hard people are expected to work to document things to prove that they are not in fact material. From a financial reporting perspective, similar to others, there seems to be something to work with. Any kind of nudge that would reduce the costs of compliance would obviously be one.
Okay, thank you. Any further? Okay, over to you, Jim.
Comments here, questions? Russell.
You know, in some ways, I think it's actually helpful that this topic is one of the first topics that we talk about, because to me it sort of sets the tone. I mean, part of me says if this is the level of implementation guidance that we think is going to be necessary to adopt this standard, we're going to be at this for a long time. You know, if I just think about it from GE's perspective, if we can't figure out what it is that we sell to our customers, we probably have bigger problems than how to recognize revenue. So I don't think we need a lot of guidance around this particular topic. I think we can figure out what we sell on the particular topic of shipping. I can see instances where we might think of shipping as a separate performance obligation, and other instances where we really think of it as cost of fulfilling the contract. And we've been answering this question for a long time, I don't think this standard would require you to think of it any differently. So from that perspective, if we need any guidance at all on this topic, to me it would just be a reinforcement that this is a judgmental area, and determining the nature of the arrangement is important when determining what your promises are in the contract. So if we think that's necessary, which seems unfortunate that you'd have to put something like that in the standard because it seems obvious, but if that's what you need to get this kind of moving in the right direction, that's what I would recommend.
So
if I heard you, you're not viewing this as a significant change to existing practice in terms of how you're thinking about going about identifying performance obligations.
Not at all, no.
Allison.
Okay, thank you. Echoing a little bit what Russell said, I guess as I had thought about identifying promised goods and services in the arrangement, my starting point or my framework is thinking about it consistent with how we think about deliverables under today's guidance for US GAAP. And oftentimes, I know I have experience working with companies and looking at contracts where there may be a list of tasks that have to be completed, and we often have discussions about, well, each individual task doesn't necessarily suggest that that's a deliverable under the current multiple element guidance, that you have to think about what is it that you're really promising to provide to your customer, what are they expecting, what are they purchasing. So similar to what Russell was just saying, that's the way that I would have approached the guidance under this standard. I think just answering the question, do we think we could potentially have some additional performance obligations compared with where we are under today's guidance? I think the one area where I think we will see an increase is in the area of marketing type incentives, where under today's guidance, the standard, oftentimes companies will account for those marketing incentives as a cost item, versus where I think the standard is headed for those types of items is that they should be thought of, just because they're a free good or service doesn't necessarily mean that it's a marketing incentive. Rather, those items should be accounted for as or potentially thought of as additional promised goods and services. So that is an area where I think we could see some incremental additional goods and services identified compared with today's practice. We do hear a lot of feedback, though, about the language in the basis, and I appreciate Henry's comments about how you need to think about the comments in the basis in terms of the context of how the standard was drafted. But I do think that, or I know that we're receiving comments that people are reading those words and thinking that inconsequential or perfunctory, not having that ability to leverage that type of guidance like we do under US GAAP today is creating some confusion. So I think maybe it was Tony over in London that had suggested if there was anything to change, maybe deleting that reference from the basis for conclusions might help the larger population of companies better understand how to apply the new standard.
So the suggestion, or at least potential there, is not necessarily to add it back to the standard, but to consider some adjustment to the basis?
At a minimum, I think that within our group, there were certainly some views that maybe adding guidance on inconsequential or perfunctory could further help companies with making that determination. But I think we all appreciate that to do that, and I think the comment was made over in London, people don't necessarily have a common framework today outside of the U.S. on how you think about inconsequential or perfunctory. So I think we appreciate that would be a significant effort to try to add that type of guidance. But if there's a change that could be made to the base, that's a small change that could certainly go a long way.
Scott?
I generally agree with a lot of what I've heard, and I'm glad to hear it. I don't think that the new standard as written changes significantly what we used to call deliverables and now call promises. I'd have identified very much about the same thing under both situations. Just a word or two on inconsequential and perfunctory, since I was in the halls of the SEC when we were thinking about that a long time ago. One of the issues that existed back then was that if you had an inconsequential or perfunctory, very small, tiny, undelivered item that you didn't have objective evidence of the fair value for, you might have concluded that you could recognize no revenue whatsoever, because under the gap that existed back then and before EITF 08-1 in particular, if you had a situation where there was an undelivered item you didn't have fair value for, standard just said no revenue, even if you knew it was small, even if you knew it wasn't the big deal. So small item, huge difference in financial reporting. So the inconsequential and perfunctory guidance helped avoid that in some situations. Under the new standard, IFRS 15, ASU 2014-9, that small item would never cause you to not be able to recognize any revenue on the contract, because there is no requirement to have objective evidence of fair value of undelivered items in order to recognize revenue. So regular materiality I think, ought to work to handle those kinds of situations. If you think something is small and immaterial, then move on. So I think we can handle it without the language in the basis did not trouble me at all, but if that's a fix that people think will relieve pressure, taking that out, I can live with that, but I think it's okay as is.
Sorry. I just wanted to, I think, just to make sure that the boards understand, in the U.S., as an auditor, one of the things we have to do is evaluate whether our clients have non-GAAP accounting policies. And if they do, we can't just go, well, oh, that's obviously okay. We have to evaluate whether they are, in fact, immaterial. And so what actually happens on the ground floor or in the field is people actually ask their clients to quantify these things. So under existing GAAP, insofar as incidental and perfunctory, that provides air cover to the auditors, which says something that is immaterial, you don't even need to quantify it because it is, in fact, in accordance with GAAP. So I don't think this is a circumstance where, like, the standard becomes inoperable because of if that is gone. I think we would be able to deal with it. But you should understand it does create kind of a nuisance factor, if you will, that we and our clients will have to deal with absent that kind of incidental and perfunctory permission, if you will.
So I want to follow up on Brian's comments. Two things. One is to Jeff or Brian. Is your observation, is that applicable for all companies or just public companies where you have to quantify immaterial items to then determine if in aggregate it's material? Jeff, do you do that in your private company practice? Is that it? Because I sense firms that do both public and private have that, but I'm trying to get, do private only or predominant private have that same view?
I don't know that there's any difference in responsibility. I do think that there's probably a higher degree of rigor and emphasis on it in the public company environment than there is in the private.
So
it's just so obviously immaterial. Mm-hmm. And now we kind of get into the sausage making aspect of auditing in a private company scenario. There's probably more permission to do that, whereas there's, in a public company scenario, you're much more likely to want a number that you can evaluate.
So my second point is what Allison talked about, how while this is a known practice in the U.S., it may not be known internationally, and it might be easier for both boards to take it out of the basis rather than to put it in. My question is, from a materiality standpoint, I heard people in London promote materiality. I hear people in the U.S. saying that doesn't really reduce the cost. Are we in a situation where we could add it in the U.S. and take it out of the basis internationally and you end up with the same result, even though the words are not the same? Because to me, I think we've been historically focused on the words have to be exactly the same, but in reality, we should be focused that the results are the same. And I'm wondering if it's the way to get the results the same here for the U.S. to put it in and for the international board to take it out of the basis. I didn't know.
Well, certainly I think that is something that you could do. I don't know that it's leveraging, literally cutting and pasting the existing guidance that we have under SAP Topic 13 and putting it into the new standard. I'm not sure that it fits quite right, each of those individual factors that you have to think about, putting that into this model when you're thinking about a control-based principle versus something that's risk and rewards, but just the idea of having inconsequential or perfunctory and putting that into the standard in the U.S., you know, I'd like to think that you'd get to a similar answer. Be interested in what others around the table might have to say about that. I'd like to think that you get to the same place, but I don't know that it's as easy as literally cutting and pasting from SAP Topic 13.
Mark? I think taking it out just at a minimum would be helpful. I mean, we can interpret it after that. If you put something in, that might be even more helpful, but I think if you just take it out. I mean, right now, we're listening here, I think, you know, maybe we're over-interpreting it here in the U.S., but the words are what the words say, so it's tough to sort of sit there and say we're going to still continue with the inconsequential and perfunctory notion, even though someone's going to point to that the basis and say they said you can't. What are you doing? So I think it'd be easier to continue if it was gone.
Mark, if the boards did remove that sentence from the basis, do you still think you'd be in the predicament that Brian described of, well, now the standard is silent and this is technically something that provides at least a little benefit to the customer, so now I need to quantify whether or not it's material?
I think based on this discussion, and if it is removed, we can point to the fact that it was removed to say that they're removing it so that we can have it. What it does is it makes something, and I appreciate what Scott says, it's immaterial, and I hear this, you know, from my colleagues overseas too. It's immaterial. Why are you dealing with it? And it's exactly what Brian said, but if you can call it not an error, then that's different. If you call it an immaterial error, we have to do what we have to do to quantify it. So
is it fair to say that if it's in the basis that says you have to consider, it's pretty hard to interpret that you don't?
Yes.
And if you take it out, you might be able to make an interpretation? I understand.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm not going to harp on the inconsequential product. I think that's fine. I think I just want to make sure Allison's point. It's the marketing type materials and even stuff that people deemed not to be part of their business. So marketing, I think like the automotive companies are a good example. They just got told that all this stuff is automatically a performance obligation, everything they provide after, even though in the past they've thought of that as either marketing or cash paid to a customer. They thought, you know, roadside assistance where the dealers were providing the roadside assistance, they're just paying for it, was a financing cash paid to a customer, and they treated it that way. They got told those are no longer, those everything that's provided afterwards must be a performance obligation. So Russell said, we know what we do. Well, they sell automotives. Now they don't. They sell automotives, they sell roadside assistance, and they got told what they sell. Timeshare companies where they give away a free set of golf clubs if you buy a timeshare. Well, now they sell golf clubs where they might have deemed that as marketing before. And you can go on. I provide a service, and I was at a company that provides two-year services, and they give away tchotchkes all the time for to sign up for their service. They might be somewhat related, but they give away, you know, free T-shirts and this or that, a jersey. You sign up for the NFL package, you get a jersey, you know, of your favorite team. Well, that's not marketing anymore, we're told. That's a deliverable in the arrangement. I'd like to continue to call them marketing. But like Allison pointed out, I think those are the things where everyone's telling us those are deliverables now, and they point to the automotive companies as saying, you know, they got told, so it's deliverable for everyone else. I'd like not to, and I'd like to be able to say those are costs, but I don't think we can. So, and with the contingent revenue gone, now that you give something away for free up front, before you could say, well, it's contingent on the service even, if you point that way. You never really dealt with it before. Now you have to recognize revenue when you give away a free jersey.
Mark, when you say told, what do you mean told? Told by the standard, interpreted by people? What do you mean by told?
The automotive companies? From what I understood, we weren't at the meeting, but from what we understand, they were told that
in what way?
At the staff meeting that they had. I don't know who was at the meeting. I wasn't there.
Jim?
Not this staff. Encouraged by the conversation of, you know, we ought to Russell's point, you know, if a company knows what they do, they sell automobiles, then they ought to start with that as the, you know, from my standpoint. And the focus ought to be on, you know, from an investor standpoint, you know, what businesses they're in and what is the information that best provides to the investor. I think in terms of you know what the TRG and the board need to do is figure out whether they need to actually tweak the standard or whether the minutes can reflect that, give permission to the preparers and the auditors to use the judgment that Russell talks about,
and get back to, you know, a reasonable place, again, with the bottom line focus on what's important to the user. You know, I would agree with Mark that, you know, if somebody's selling an automobile, that's what the users are focused on, and these ancillary things are probably not, you know, are not important to them, and in many cases, you know, they could be viewed as a contract cost, or, you know, or a cost to fulfill, and that model worked today, and I think you could get there with some judgment the way the standard is written, but I think it's important that we move in that direction.
Brett, then Scott.
A few reactions, I guess. For starters, the notion about the materiality, I think that it is a challenge in this environment in terms of having to prove that something's immaterial. But I do think that, you know, we do need to continue to use common sense in these cases. And the standard already has reference to things like material rights. You account for something when it's a material right. So to me, that suggests that sometimes there may be immaterial rights, coupons that are, you know, freely given out. And are we really expecting companies to actually have to justify that, you know, quantitatively versus a qualitative judgment? And I guess I don't believe that's a sustainable model. And so I think the notion of using materiality is important, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. But and sometimes things are going to be clearly immaterial, and we can pass on them qualitatively. So to me, inconsequential is in fact synonymous with immaterial. So I think the fact that the basis says you have to think about inconsequential or perfunctory obligations is in conflict with the notion of using materiality. So I would be supportive. We would be supportive, as we've said before, of removing it from the basis. I do get concerned when we think about introducing perfunctory in particular, because I don't know that perfunctory is widely understood. And I think if you read the dictionary definition of perfunctory, it might suggest that a lot of things could be routine and you know, done without care, if you will, and repetitively, whatever definition you want to use of perfunctory. And I do think that, frankly, I do think in even the auto example we're talking about, that we've been thinking about those as, in fact, obligations. Those what they may think of as marketing incentives are, in fact, you know, free maintenance that are provided to a customer, and are sometimes sold separately. So while they may be relatively, you know, insignificant compared to the car, nonetheless, they are obligations, just like point and loyalty programs are obligations of the companies. So I think if we introduce perfunctory into the model as being an out, then we need to do that with eyes wide open, because I think the impact of that's going to be that a lot of things that we now are thinking about as being performance obligations under the standard won't be anymore.
If I recall right, but Scott, you were there, it's inconsequential and perfunctory.
It's or.
So
it was
or. Oh, okay.
And so
I take your point then.
Yeah, importantly, if you look at how that's used today, and Scott described what it's used for today, you know, also there's sort of this notion that if you didn't do it, the customer would get a refund, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something that, you know, it's the sure. Toy in the box, the cereal box, if you will, that right. Shouldn't hold up revenue recognition. So I guess I would wonder if we think that might be an out for some of these things that maybe are causing some headache. I'm not sure it even works, because it frankly is for example, with shipping, would a customer say, well, don't worry about the shipping. If you don't do it, I'll still pay you. I mean, it's obviously important to the customer in many of those arrangements. So I think we just have to, you know, make sure we're doing something that's actually helpful, I guess.
Scott.
Just primarily wanted to react to what Brian said. I have heard about this issue coming up during the audits where, you know, the discussion is that under the new standard, these little things, you're going to have to quantify them to prove that they're immaterial, whereas under the existing guidance, you know, we can just call them inconsequential and we don't have to address them again. If that's the concern, if that's the problem that's causing us to think about making changes to the standard, either taking things out of the basis or adding things, you know, I worry about changing the accounting standards to correct what is an issue coming up during audits. It seems like there ought to be a way, and I don't suggest that I know what it is, but it seems like there ought to be a way in the auditing standards or auditing interpretive guidance or something that can relieve that pressure if it's coming up during the audit as opposed to other places. And obviously I'm not suggesting that, you know, you get to adopt an accounting policy and as long as you follow it, nobody ever has to worry about whether it's a material deviation from GAAP, but it doesn't seem like the things that we're talking about here are anything that anybody reasonably suspects might be leading to a material departure from GAAP, yet we're going through a lot of effort or planning to go through a lot of effort in this case and some current standards where I think it's happening already. But I would worry about changing accounting standards to relieve a pressure that's coming up during the audit.
That point comes up with increasing frequency. It seems every standard we deal with now is the request for, can you help us shed away some immaterial items because of an auditing consequence? We had the same thing in our lease standard of people saying, can we set lease capitalization thresholds and call them not an error because we don't want to have to evaluate. So this isn't unique, and we do end up spending a lot of time talking about immaterial things. Comments on the phone?
Jim, it's Jay Hansen. Couple thoughts. This is all helpful discussion for us at the PCAOB to think about. Is there something that we could say about this that might alleviate what is kind of the unstated pressures that come from us to the auditors? And I appreciate Scott Tobbs' discussion of it. But this does kind of remind me, I know it's a different situation, kind of reminds me of every company on earth for capitalization of property, plant, and equipment establishes a de minimis threshold that they don't capitalize something that's less than 100x units. Or whatever their threshold is, and it doesn't seem to bother anybody in practice that that's what it is, and I haven't heard of companies saying, well, I need to quantify every pencil and paper clip that might be called a fixed asset if you had a zero capitalization threshold, and that doesn't seem to bother anybody. But I know this is different, but it kind of reminds me of that discussion. But if there are specific things that we can do to help, we'll certainly take that under consideration. And I'll ask my colleague Mr. Bauman if he wants to weigh in at all on this as well.
Well, I'll just add that, you know, our current standards do require that companies accumulate errors that are more than trivial, and the trivial is something that's greater than, is something well less than inconsequential according to the standards. So I think the sentence that's in the basis right now, that it's the board's intent to not exempt an entity from accounting for performance obligations that the entity might regard as being perfunctory or inconsequential, would certainly cause a company to have to collect all of those and evaluate them, and someone needs to make a decision about them. So, yeah, I think this is appropriate for the board to take an action on this sentence.
Okay, Jim, we haven't got anything more on the telephone?
Can I ask the team?
Sure.
What I'm hearing is the first recommendation of the TRG is to look at taking a sentence out of the basis. Would the team be ready to do that when we bring your project in February?
Yeah, so one of the issues that'll be covered in the paper is this topic, and that's one of the alternatives we have in there, so we are considering
that. So we'll specifically consider that in February.
That's right.
Okay, yep. Great.
Okay, Ian.
Okay, thanks, Jim. So summing up, I think we heard that this is not or shouldn't be regarded as a major problem. I think the first thing. I think the statement and the basis of conclusions might be causing some confusion, and it's worth looking at whether it should stay there or go. I don't think there was strong feeling for adding material to the standard. There's the question of materiality, and everybody knows that's a judgment call. And what would we write about it if we were to write about it in the standard? I think would be difficult. So Russ is a bit more bullish than me. He's got it coming to the board already. I think we should have a think about it, but I guess he's probably right in the long run. Any others, anything I've missed out on the discussion that was important?
Ian, that just maybe I think I heard from people that they're fundamentally not viewing this as identifying significantly different performance obligations, save a couple points. Allison's point about in the past, if you said you gave a free item, certainly we know some examples where the thing that was called free in the past is being identified as a performance obligation, and then the point about inconsequential and perfunctory. But fundamentally, the model shouldn't be sorting out hundreds of performance obligations, and I heard agreement around that.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, well, that's good. Now, if that was an unimportant one, I hope we get through the important ones.